Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are America's boys on the right path toward a successful and happy adulthood? And what's to be done for those who seem to be moving in the wrong direction? My guest today has focused much of his career as a family therapist and writer on understanding the unique social and developmental patterns of boys as compared with girls, and on trying to help parents and educators to understand and fulfill those needs. Michael Gurian is a family therapist and author of 25 books, including The Wonder of Boys. His latest release is called The Purpose of Boys, Helping Our Sons Find Meaning, Significance, and Direction in Their Lives. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
I guess part of the issue here is that the role of men, and therefore of boys, has changed in recent decades. Can you talk about what's different today?
Yeah, that really is a big deal. It's sort of the macro. It's the macro issue. The male role was relatively well defined, as everyone knows, and we've gone through a period of 40 or 50 years of looking at it, male roles and female roles, looking at them and deconstructing and reconstructing. And what I think we've done very well is we've constructed pathways for girls. I have two daughters, by the way, 19 and 16. So obviously I've been involved in that, and that's been a really great thing. We haven't really looked carefully enough at how boys grow and what they need from families and schools. And specifically, we haven't looked at the fact that there's a flaw in trying to get rid of the male role or saying, well, the male role is not that big a deal. They'll just find their way. That's flawed. And, the Purpose of Boys argues that the reason is not just social, but it's also biological. It has to do with puberty. It has to do with testosterone. It has to do with how men are set up, boys are set up. And they really need to be oriented toward a purpose, motivation, goal setting. And the society has to support that through all its institutions.
Do you think part of the discomfort we're feeling today is that women sort of fought for their new roles and men have had to simply adjust to what women wanted?
Yeah, I think, again, that's exactly what happened. Throughout what we call the patriarchy, it was the opposite, and women had to adjust to men. And over the last 40 years or so, women said, as did many men like myself, they said, heck with that, we're moving forward. And so basically, I think that males then started adjusting toward females at these sort of big thinking levels, in the culture. And now, the Purpose of Boys, now in 2009, the Purpose of Boys says, okay, so we now really have to find parity. We can't swing too far one way because at this point, in 2009, to raise generations of males who are sort of playing video games or who were not really supervising, not really helping developmentally, not schooling in the correct ways, this now will backfire on girls and women. It'll backfire on my daughters, and it'll backfire, all over the industrialized world. And boys are behind girls in all of the industrialized countries in their overall educational marker. So it's not just an American phenomenon. So I think you're absolutely right that this is a sort of industrial world, a post-patriarchal and post-feminist issue. We have to move forward, take the best of the past, and now look at purpose as, I hope, a new word that we can use so we don't have to worry too much about the word role, which a lot of people don't like, male role. I think we can move forward and talk about male purpose, and it will be in partnership with women.
Well, let's talk about the best of the past. What did older cultures and previous generations understand about raising boys that we have lost sight of today?
There were a number of things that we need to carry forward. One was that boys are developmental creatures, as is everyone, and that there are certain developmental moments that need to be protected, and they're pivot points. And, obviously attachment with the baby is key. Yes, absolutely crucial. Then we need to start looking, as the boy is becoming what we call school age, we need to already start looking at how is he developing his independence? How is he developing his self-motivation, his goal setting? And I give sort of a metaphorical but literal example of, even if you have a 2 or 3 year old boy and he's sitting in his chair having dinner and he drops the spoon, our instinct would be pick up the spoon for that kid, right? I mean,
sure.
I think that's natural for all of us, certainly for our daughters as well. But I would argue, wait a minute, let's say to the boy, okay, get down out of your chair and pick up that spoon. And I mean this as much, again, literal as symbolic, because what we want to start doing as early as possible is helping this boy set goals and move his life, you know, forward with goals and not do too much for him, help him to do. By the time he gets to 8 or 9, another developmental moment is pre-puberty. And this was a developmental moment in which the our ancestors, and it really now does not matter the race of anyone listening, all of our ancestors started looking toward 1 or 2 key men. And the father obviously was a key man, but if he was gone, many fathers were gone at war or working in a big city or somewhere else, 1 or 2 other key men stepped in to help mom. So that's another developmental moment. And then certainly puberty, then the rites of passage started. They would have rites of passage for 13-year-olds and 15-year-olds. So these are just a few examples of some of the good stuff that came from the past.
You also write that it's really important for boys to be taught that they are descended from people who matter. What does that mean, and why is it so vital to their healthy development?
Yeah, I have a chapter where I actually retell the story of Joseph, and I show him to be actually kind of a mythic figure that repeats all over, like Arjuna in India. You know, that's sort of a universal story. But I use Joseph because many people in our culture would know it. And one thing about Joseph is that he had a birthright. So he knew that he was carrying on his shoulders and in his soul, let's say, I would use that word, he was carrying something very important from the past, so that he had a built-in motivation. He had people he needed to live up to. He had imagery and idealization from the past that he needed to live up to. So he's being motivated to serve. And, you know, his birthright was a birthright of service. And my definition of the purpose of boys is to become successful men who serve their families and communities. And I believe every boy wants to do this. And if he develops well, he will. And, you know, that will be great. Well, Joseph's an example of someone who had this birthright of service and of success. And so that really helps. And, you know, when we work with, for instance, African-American communities, we find that quite often, this is incredibly complicated for any boy, but it can be very complicated if the only descendants you remember are slaves. And I have a whole chapter, as you know, that looks at this, helping African-American boys, because they're in a significant issue regarding birthright. And so we have to help them go back, further back, you know, into their ancestry before slavery, so they can see what is all this beautiful stuff that they're carrying that even predates that. So every boy, I think we need to be thinking birthright. So the word is birthright or legacy. What is passed into him that will help motivate him in his life?
Well, and the Joseph story is a particularly interesting choice in terms of an example, because here was someone who had a birthright, but he also had absolutely everything stacked against him, despite what he ought to have inherited. And you write that it's important to give them chances to fail. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, because Joseph, he had this birthright, and then, of course, he overdid it, as many of our boys do, a sense of entitlement, or the family sense of entitlement, you know. So Joseph is growing up, and he has a dream, and he says, I've just had a dream that everyone's going to serve me. Well, you know, that's that. He's not picking up his own spoon, you know. He's got such a sense of entitlement. Everything's being given him. He's being praised all the time by Rachel and by Jacob, who are so happy to have him and all this, and he goes too far. And obviously his brothers rebel against that. And he now hits failure. And in this story, he hits it through his brothers. Every boy will hit failure in some way. And in the Joseph story, failure is actually good for him, because he had to come down a peg. And obviously, very dramatic, obviously, you know, he becomes enslaved, and that's a really sad thing. But the symbolic, you know, the symbology of it is he's failing and he's learning. And then he meets a number of mentors in Egypt, and he develops. So we need to let these guys fail. You know, we can't overprotect these guys. And I say this, I have daughters, say this of girls too, truthfully. We've got to let these kids fail and not worry, oh, I got to protect their self-esteem all the time. Part of boys developing goals and motivation and a sense of service and an ability to develop the self, the soul, is that they fail a number of times over a period of years, and they figure out who to be. And I think Joseph does do that. And one way that we will know our kids are set up for failure will be if they are too entitled. And the sad thing about that is we may hold off the failure until they're about 20. And then at about 20, they don't grow up. And that's when they really fail, and that's very confusing for them, because then they spend their 20s thinking, well, what am I? it would be better to let them fail when they're kids, when we can protect them and help them as they fail.
How serious is the problem? You know, people focus on this a lot these days, of giving everybody a trophy just for showing up.
Well, if we're going to do that, you know, I'm a loving person. I want everyone to feel good. But if we're going to do that, I tell you, we also then have to give a separate set of trophies for the winners. So it doesn't have to be an either or. And this is developmental. You know, for four-year-olds, I see, you know, like soccer, I coached four-year-olds, you know. I mean, it's just bunch ball anyway, so let's give them all a trophy. That's sweet. But when we get to the point where we can see that these kids are trying to develop through competition, we want to not be afraid of that, because for both boys and girls, competition is really, really helpful for self-development. So while obviously some people can take it too far and become very mean, we don't want that. But in terms of the institutional structures that support competitive development, we would want to give out three or four trophies for the three or four best, and then we'd certainly find to give everyone else something. But these three or four trophies need to be you know, solidly winners, because now I'm going to switch especially to boys, because boys, starting at 8 or 9, they really need to develop through competition. They are going to face a world that's incredibly competitive, so it's just real for them. And also, they're moving into a hormone, testosterone, which is an aggression on competition hormone. So they need to start succeeding and failing and succeeding and failing inside themselves, because this hormone is going to hit them for you know, it's going to take them 5 years or so to accommodate this aggression and competition hormone. So even the most mellow boy, some boys are obviously more mellow than others, even that most mellow boy, he'll play chess or he'll play video games. There'll be some way in which even this mellow guy is trying to compete, because he's driven from within to experiment with a self that's somewhat competitive.
It's also interesting, you write that boys in particular only value praise that they know came from something they did right.
Yeah, in the first few years of life, and you know, we could go to the Joseph again, you know, in the first few years of life, gosh, praise is just great. I mean, every kid just loves being praised, obviously. But as the boy starts growing and he sees the big world out there, he starts entering school, and then as he moves, you know, 8, 9, 10, where he's pre-puberty, now if people just keep saying good job to him, he's going to gradually stop trusting it and believing it. And we, as parents, lose our credibility. Coaches lose their credibility to help this boy develop, because boys tend to want to be praised for their achievement, and they tend to believe the praise that is for their achievement, and they don't tend to get as much out of blanket praise. And there's actually a chemical reason for this that I go into in the book, which is girls, when they get someone says something like, good job, that stimulates the verbal centers in the brain, that stimulates the brain to secrete oxytocin, which is this wonderful bonding chemical, and it feels really great to them. But boys have a lot less of this thing. And so we say good job to boys. It doesn't actually stimulate the brain in the same way. So this is just one biochemical reason that boys tend to go out and do. They're more, you know, they want to get out there and do it, and then they want to rise status, they want to gain status in their group or in the eyes of the mentor or their mom or their dad or whoever it is. They want to gain status by actually accomplishing something. The words themselves don't stimulate as much of the brain. It's the action that's stimulating. And another reason for this is in the brain, males have a more developed and there's more blood flow through the cerebellum, which is a doing center of the brain. And girls get more blood flow in some other parts of the brain. So you tend to see males doing, and trying to gain their status that way. So praise, studies from really all over the world supporting this, praise ought to be targeted to all kids. But for boys, as they get to 8, 9, 10, it becomes very important.
Michael Gurian is my guest. He is a family therapist and author. His new book is called The Purpose of Boys, Helping Our Sons Find Meaning, Significance, and Direction in Their Lives. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Gurian is my guest. He is a family therapist and author. His new book is called The Purpose of Boys, Helping Our Sons Find Meaning, Significance, and Direction in Their Lives. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Michael, I have to tell you, I love the stuff you have in here about video games, and I couldn't agree more that they seem to provide a reward for a lot of effort towards something that doesn't ultimately matter, and it seems that too much of that could be really dangerous for a boy or for a girl, but boys seem more drawn to these very often.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, as to the thing you just said, the end thing, you know, people think, well, why is this an important thing for boys? Well, because they are so drawn. The right side of the male brain, unlike the female brain, obviously there's great variety, but in this, this is the way it is, male and female. The right side of the male brain is much more spatial than in the female brain, and girls and women do verbals. They talk and have these feelings on the right side, but boys tend to look for objects moving in space, and so and that's the space around them. And video games fit that. So we're never going to see a situation in which we have as many girls playing, number one, aggressive video games, and number two, video games where objects move around, like NASCAR. These are going to always attract males more than females on average. And so hence, that the baseline is already ratcheted for males to absorb themselves into these video games. Now, these video games can be, you know, neat. I mean, they can feel good. And if someone listening has a very high-performing son having no trouble at all and he plays an hour of video games a day, okay, no problem. But let's say the boy's not doing his chores. He's not doing his homework. He's not performing well in areas of competence. So he's underachieving and underperforming. And he's playing couple hours of these video games a day. The further brain problem with that is that video games stimulate a nucleus in the brain, a reward center called the caudate, and it stimulates every time you achieve in the video game, that boy's brain thinks, I've accomplished something. And so he goes to bed that night, and his brain is saying, man, I accomplished 20 things today because I moved up 20 levels today. But the problem is he actually didn't. As you're saying, this nucleus lit up as if he accomplished something, but he didn't accomplish anything that's going to ultimately help motivate him to succeed, to do well in school, to do well at work, to do, you know, all the things that we need him to do to care for his family later in life. So that caudate nucleus thing is a big deal, and what I beg parents to do is remember that video games are totally a privilege, and they should be used as a reward or privilege. They're not a right. The kid doesn't have a right to them. They're a privilege that we use to help motivate him to do the things that are really important.
On the other hand, and I think this is really ironic in a way, when it comes to school, you explain that boys connect best with their studies when they are able to see it as directly relevant to their lives, which is apparently not something they're looking for necessarily from video games. How do teachers and parents help demonstrate the relevance of the education we want these boys to have?
Well, a first thing I would say is use as a wedge, if people are having this dialogue, use as a wedge homework. There's a lot of talk about homework. So one of the reasons that boys get the majority of D's and F's is they don't do their homework and or they don't hand in their homework. And we could take the position, especially those of us who are educators, could say, well, okay, that's just bad. They should do it and they should turn it in because we told them to do homework. On the other hand, you could also say, well, wait a minute. Is it possible that all these boys who are not doing their homework are trying to say to us, a lot of these worksheets are not relevant. I'm not going to remember a thing about them. They're not going to have anything to do with my future life. And I, at especially middle school and high school age now, I at 12, 13, 14, I'm looking to do things and be mentored in things that are going to help me develop my purpose in life. I think we need to listen to both. I think, obviously, we have to hold the authority of schools and parents. Kids should do their homework. But on the other hand, we need to revamp homework, try to understand it better, and get the wisdom from these guys. So meet somewhere in the middle, because a lot of the homework that is being sent home actually has very little relevance or no relevance to the future. And boys tend to be very project-driven, especially as they're in adolescence. And while some boys, you know, at the top are going to perform in any setting, doesn't really matter how you educate them, they're going to do great. But a lot of boys, you really need to get them into one-week projects. Okay, we're going to do this science project for 1 week, and we're going to focus all our learning on this project. Well, now, when we assign homework for that project, the boys want to do it because they see the relevance of it to this project that feels relevant to them. So I obviously, you know, the Gurian Institute, we have this corporation that goes and tries to help schools with all this. And one of the things we're trying to do is help them revamp the homework curricula so that they can do some where it's just imposed on the kid, but they can also do more project-driven stuff that more kids are going to want to do.
Yeah, what's so interesting about that is that so many schools these days, it's sort of a badge of how good your school is, how many hours of homework a night kids are spending, completing. And so in other words, if the homework's not any good for them, there's really no point.
Well, yeah, we got to at least have the dialogue. I mean, we can't, you know, we are all, and I think Barack Obama and his whole administration is helping with this. Everyone is now saying in 2009, look, there are things that are not right about the way we educate kids in the U.S. And I think one of the things that's on that list that we have to dialogue about and come to consensus about is the homework issue and frame it now so that we say these kids have a little bit of wisdom here. A 12-year-old. In some ways, a 12-year-old is acting out by not doing homework, but in some ways, a 12-year-old is saying, I want to have a purpose in life, you know, so mentor me toward that. And there's wisdom there. So let's all, as we revamp it, let's not see quantity, how much homework gets done. Let's not see that as the only good thing. Let's see quality. And ultimately, that would be good for girls. It would be good for every child. But one thing we want to remember is that girls, that oxytocin I talked about, that brain gets stimulated by doing these worksheets in a different way than for boys. More of the female brain is stimulated by words that are seen on worksheets. And so, you know, okay, I'm going to go do my, like I have two daughters. Okay, I'm going to go do my homework and kind of sprawl out, listen to music, do the homework. Male brain is set up differently. That will stimulate some boys, but a lot of boys have to be moving around. They have to be doing things to learn. Yeah, I guess I'm agreeing with you, and we need to meet in the middle.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Michael Gurian is here, and we're talking about his new book, The Purpose of Boys. Let's speak to Charlie in Dallas. Hi, Charlie.
Yes, I have a question about the use of the term little man. I hear infant boys, preschool boys, toddler boys, all referred to as little men and how proud their parents are. And I don't refer to my daughter that way as a little woman because it feels like it's pressuring for a status that a little boy isn't.
Thank you. I think one of the reasons that people instinctively do this is that with boys, we as human beings have an instinct that we got to start early trying to get our boys directed toward purpose or toward becoming successful men. And we kind of instinctually know that they've got this energy, what I call boy energy. They've got this boy energy, and we need to shape that boy energy into man energy. And so I think that's what we're doing instinctively. I actually don't think there's any harm in it at all. I don't think it pressures them badly. The only negative would be if someone means by little man something bad, like, you know, a man hits people. Then of course, the association is a negative one. But in general, I think it's fine. And I think one of the reasons we don't do it with girls, and this is sort of a deep thing inside of us as human beings that might take a little more talk than just a second, but I'll try to say that with girls, we already see by the time they're 1 or 2 years old or 3 years old in their preschools, they put a pillow under their shirts and they say, I can have a baby. And the boys put a pillow under their shirts, and within about 5 minutes, they are disabused of the idea that they can have a baby. It becomes very clear to them they're not going to have a baby. And so I think there's something also instinctive in human beings that girls will become women when they menstruate and when they demonstrate that they can have a baby, and that while women will do hundreds of other things in their lives, this is something deep in the human psyche, whereas there isn't anything equivalent for boys. So we don't tend to say it as much with girls because we assume it. But with boys, I think we're early on trying to direct them to become successful men through that phrase.
Are we better at teaching young girls to be good mothers than we are at teaching young boys to be good fathers?
Yes, I would absolutely say that. I think that that's especially true in this culture and in this new millennium. We are girls have two advantages. One is that there are certain chemicals like oxytocin that set them up already to bond, and so they're going to work through those chemicals to bond. So boys have less of those chemicals, so there's a sort of natural, you know, cultures have always taken boys and said, here's how you do it, because there are certain chemicals that boys don't have. We have other chemicals that are great, but we don't have those. So there's a natural thing going on that we're forgetting. And number two, there's enough male imagery out there that denigrates fatherhood or that just doesn't pay attention to it, that only pays attention to guys shooting things, and doesn't pay attention to guys caring for kids. So there's enough of that imagery out there that we got to fight against that to train our kids. And I would add to all of this that as fathers move further away from families, divorce or separation or abandonment, whatever it is, as fathers move farther away from families, and then as grandfathers and uncles move farther away from families because they live far away, that's a significant disadvantage for these young guys because they then don't have the modeling of not just dad, but of uncles, grandfathers, and other men who are fathering. So it's actually a key issue. And most of our negative statistics right now for both boys and girls are correlated with, not caused by, but correlated with the lack of that father and father influence.
I do want to talk about what you've written about the development of empathy in young boys, because as you point out, it develops sort of on parallel to when girls' empathy develops, but it may manifest itself in a very different way than what we have been trained to imagine is empathy.
Yeah, especially in the last three decades or so, I would say the word empathy has gotten associated with what I call direct empathy, which is, are you okay? How are you doing? Looking a person in the eye, trying to see where they're hurt right there and saying, I will help you. And that's direct empathy. It's not only observational, seeing if the person is hurt or how, but it's also verbal and interacting verbally with the person right then. And it often will involve touching the person, hugging the person, doing something that really helps the person to feel good. So that's direct empathy. And that's how we've defined all of empathy to a great extent. But there's another kind of empathy that is practiced much more by males, and it's this more aggressive. I call it aggression nurturance. And it's nurturance that happens within the system of the behavior. And so I'll give an example to explain. If the kids are playing street hockey or any game, and they're, let's say, 12 years old, and one of them is knocked down or falls down, the girl who's involved in this game, let's say she's 12, she comes over on her skates. She's more likely to bend down, touch this child, say, are you okay? What can I do for you? That kind of an energy. A boy is more likely to come by on his skates, look at this child, and discern in his mind that this child is okay, just a skinned knee, and say, get up, we need you. Well, that's actually very empathic. What it does is it raises the self-esteem of this fallen child by associating this child with and attaching this child with the goal. And the goal, according to this 12-year-old boy, is to make a goal. We need you to help us win this game. Well, I argue, as you know, that raises the self-esteem and it is just as empathic of this fallen child as is the direct empathy. They're both crucial for humanity, and they both raise the self-esteem of the fallen child. And I'm putting in parentheses that it's clear that this child is not, bleeding and needing an ambulance. So it's a skinned knee or something like that. So one thing I ask parents to do is to keep developing direct empathy with boys, keep looking in the eye, keep hugging them, keep helping them use their words, keep doing all that great stuff, and respect and observe and respect the parts of them that are doing this other kind of nurturance, this other kind of empathy. Because as we enjoy that more and we see the use of that more, I think we will reinvigorate fatherhood, we'll reinvigorate areas of male development that we've been afraid of and that we really ought not be afraid of. We ought to be doing more to supervise and direct.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Markin in Dalworthington Gardens. Hey, Markin.
Hi. I have a 2-year-old boy, and like many 2-year-old boys, he's been biting lately. So I'm kind of wondering, developmentally, what's going on with that? I've heard from a lot of parents that they have the same problem.
Well, okay, so biting is, you have to deal with it, and of course it's a phase, right? I mean, if it goes on for months and months, you got to talk to a pediatrician and look for help there in the local community. Generally, though, it's a phase, and it's a way that the brain and the body are trying to deal with the aggression that's inside, the frustrations, and stimulation, the way the world is stimulating this child, That brain and body are growing, and as they grow, and this is a strategy to try to stabilize the system. It's also an aggression strategy. I mean, there's a number of things that it is doing for that child. Of course, it's not appropriate behavior, and that's part of the journey. And so whatever system you're using to deal with it, timeouts or, whatever the system is, that's going to be very important, and it's going to help this to be a phase and the boy to move out of the phase.
We have an email here from Janice in Dallas who says, can you address the issue of what schools do to boys, specifically elementary age, when they provide little or no time for physical activity and expect complete focus and attention? My son compensates by daydreaming in class.
Yeah, you're just not alone. I mean, this is going on all over and in some ways getting worse because of budget cuts and so on, folks are cutting out more recess. And so at the macro level, I have to say what's happening to boys is that schools and teachers are very caring. They really care about kids, but they're not trained in how the male brain learns. So they move into the assumption, well, let's just go into this classroom and assume everyone's the same, please, because we have so many people to educate. And so we're just going to set up this system, and this is going to be the system. They're going to sit there for an hour or two, whatever it is, and they're going to do these things, and it's going to work. Well, in a classroom of, say, 25, there will be five boys who are not going to be able to accommodate that. Their cerebellum is more developed, and parts of the brain that make them more physically active and that require them to learn by doing and require them to have breaks, brain breaks or physical breaks at certain times in the day so that they don't drift off into these what are called rest states where their brains shut off and they daydream or they start tapping a pencil or they start creating discipline problems to try to keep their brains awake. And this is a predominantly male issue. When male brains and female brains are scanned and in this daydream state, we find that most of the male brain is shutting off. So memory centers are shutting off, verbal centers are shutting off. The things you need to learn are shutting off. Whereas for girls, even when they get in a daydream state, they're still taking notes. Their verbal centers are still active. Their memory centers are still active. So this is a brain difference. And as the schools learn more about it, they will need to add in more physical time. And if they can't add in recess because it's a policy, what the teachers do, which is very innovative, is they allow these guys, there's generally five of them, to move around in a safe, well-disciplined way in the classroom that keeps their brains awake while they're listening.
Michael Gurian, let me have you stop because we've got to take a break here. Michael Gurian is my guest. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Gurian is here. His new book is called The Purpose of Boys, Helping Our Sons Find Meaning, Significance, and Direction in Their Lives. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Wanted you to have a chance to finish your thought, Michael. You said schools ought to think about letting these boys sort of move around in a safe place during the school day.
Yeah, this is working really well. Folks might say, well, those five boys, are in the back of the classroom moving around. It's going to wreck things for other people, but it actually doesn't. And in terms of our research base, we've trained 50,000 teachers now in the last 12 years on this. This is one of the things that's having a lot of success. Another thing that's having success is for them to be squeezing something like a squeeze ball, a Nerf ball, something that is non-offensive to anyone. You just squeeze it in your non-writing hand. And these daydreaming boys, if they can't get out, go out to recess, let's say, this can work well. They're squeezing this thing, and their brain stays more awake, and they stay more focused. So certain memory centers stay more focused, verbal centers stay more focused. Because, again, it's an issue of keeping this brain out of that rest state where most of the brain shuts down.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Little Elm and speak with Charles. Hey, Charles.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
This is a fascinating conversation, and I was just curious if your guest had an insight into why some communities seem to have much better success raising their boys, and I'm talking in particular about the Asian community, and I'm just wondering if you had any insight into that.
There's been a lot of fascinating research, and I don't think anyone knows for sure. yet. So here are some things that I think we know. One thing that we're looking at, and I think we know a little about it, is that certain communities eat certain foods, like that have more omega-3s. I mean, there's study of that, just the food and the diet. And certain other communities are eating high-fat, high-sugar, low omega-3 diets. And so there's research on what could be perhaps going on just at the level of nutrition and feeding the brain. So that's one thing to consider. Another that I think we're even further on in understanding is that certain communities are so close-knit and have such high expectations of education, and those expectations are connected to the four or five people who are raising the child. So the mentors, the parents, the grandparents, aunts, uncles, their high expectations and their support of the academics of this child are so interwoven into the life of the child that there's no escaping it, you know. I mean, anywhere this child turns, four or five people are saying, you need to succeed, and what can we give you to succeed? Go do your homework. We'll help you. You know what I mean? Here's what you need to do better homework. And that is very visceral. It's very human, and it can put high pressure on a lot of these kids, like these Asian kids, but it also can create a lot of success.
We have an email here from Anne who says, we work with incarcerated juveniles 14 to 17 who generally come from fatherless backgrounds. What advice would you give to our women volunteers who are more abundant and more present in these kids' lives than our men volunteers to help them coach and developmentally encourage the boys without seeming to condone their aggressive behavior?
Well, the first thing is that, and I say this based on working with Criminal Justice, Department of Justice, and so on, is to make sure that all of those women are trained in what we're talking about here. A lot of the women who are helping in the criminal justice community have not gone through training on how the male brain works. So they have great instincts and so on, but they haven't gone through training in it. And so their intuition, their instincts are not as developed as they would like. And that actually is the biggest thing I think they can do. And that's bigger than any tips that I'm going to give, though I'm going to give a couple. But you know what I mean? I mean, just getting to understand those brains better. Now, one thing in terms of tips, one thing that can work well is to work with them in groups and get them to do two things. It will take a long time. One is get them to try to understand this hole that is inside them because they were not fathered. So their understanding of their own maleness and masculinity is in some ways disconnected from their behavior, and they need to understand this hole, you know. And by that, I simply mean that psychologically, they're constantly in some form of darkness, and they're doing things like they did drugs, they did crime, in order to try to perform in ways that in which they're trying to get approval for someone who wasn't there. And this is all very psychological, but it's very important to them. And group work, I was a contract counselor at a prison for 3 years and ran groups, and this group work can work very well, and we got to get the males talking about it, not just her, right? She's going to have to facilitate them in helping each other with this. A second thing is get them moving around. One of the things that women often do as therapists is sit down. They want people to sit down and talk. And for a lot of these guys, they're high testosterone, high energy guys. Get them moving around, get them playing basketball, and then do the group. Right after they've played 20 minutes of basketball, have them sit down and do the group. This is a brain tip to help with getting guys to open up to deal with some of these issues. And it's as they open up to deal with these issues that we can say to them, okay, what's aggression and what's violence? And a very important theme for incarcerated males is to give them a better line between aggression and violence than they have. They see aggression and violence sort of as all one thing. They've probably seen someone be incredibly violent, and they've modeled that. What she's going to be needing to do is to get them to understand that aggression is natural, but here's where aggression turns to violence. So as soon as you use a weapon against someone, or as soon as you hit someone, that's now violence. That's not aggression. So those are a couple things that can be done.
Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi there. I had a question regarding the role of ritual, in particular, initiation rites for men, well, for boys moving into manhood, and what role that might play in our culture, given that it seems at least that we have really moved away from any formal, if we ever had it, any formal way to do that. And given that a lot of cultures in the world do, what might be the role of that for men and boys in our culture in the United States today?
Yeah, that is it's a big question. The last chapter of The Purpose of Boys, chapter 8, is completely about that. Actually, and the epigraph of that chapter is the African saying, if you don't initiate the boys into manhood, they'll burn the village down. So that's stark, obviously. And what it's trying to say is what I think you're trying to say, which is that this is very important. So what I've done over the years in this research and in working with families is develop four initiation, and of course we call them rites of passage, four rites of passage that are family-friendly and community-friendly. One happens at 10, one happens at 13, one happens at 15 to 16, and one happens at 18. So I sort of lay those out and in that chapter, and it's all, you know, what mentors can do, what parents can do. So I won't do that on the air. That's too much. But what I would say is if you look toward trying to create a rite of passage at 10, 13, 15, and 18, by the time that boy is 18, you won't regret it. No one listening will regret it, because by the time that person is 18, what he's done is gone through a ritual that brings in all of his bonding community, the people who care about him, and he's done it four times. He's also had to accomplish goals. He's done that four times. He's had to meet challenges in a number of cases with others, with peer males, with his friends, because some of them go through the rite of passage together. That really builds camaraderie and helps. And by the time he's 18, he is really going to be a leg up in terms of his maturation and development into manhood. And if folks want more detail, Chapter 8 of The Purpose of Boys actually lays out what the communities can do.
How useful are things like Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts?
I think they're crucial. I think Boy Scouts has gone through some difficulties because it got involved in that court case, you know, revolving around whether a gay male can be a parent, you know, a parent working in there. And that kind of distracted the folks from seeing the great value of Boy Scouts. And so I mean, I over the years have done quite a bit with Boy Scouts, and I just get more and more impressed with how they understand the development of boys. And they set goals. You know, there are badges that need to be earned. There's a lot of camaraderie. They help the parents, moms and dads, you know, and mentors. They help all of them to understand these guys and what these guys need. And guys who come out of Boy Scouts, and of course, you know, the headquarters is right there near you all in Irving, Texas.
Sure.
Yeah. Guys that come out of Boy Scouts, when they have studied, you know, and done Harris polls and studied them, they found that per capita, these guys end up higher up, more successful, more goal-oriented, you know. So I think some folks are throwing out Boy Scouts because they're mad about this court case, but I would beg folks to, especially if you have any doubt about is there a community for your son, look to Boy Scouts, because Boy Scouts can be a community that can fill in. If there isn't a father around, can fill in. If there is a father around, can help the father and the son bond.
Aside completely from the Cub Scouts and the court case, are there any special considerations for boys who happen to be gay?
Well, boys who are gay, you know, around 5%, some say 5 to 10%, somewhere in there, 5 to 10%, let's say, are developing as homosexuals. We now know of two biological factors for that. One is genetic, and the other is a part of the brain that's set differently in utero. Obviously, the social challenges are severe because there's so much anti-gay sentiment. And then obviously, for folks on the religious side, it's not a science issue for them. It's a whole other issue for them. So that's something. If you have a boy who's developing as a homosexual, you know, that boy is going to need some real care. And I think the worst thing that can happen is when parents turn away from that boy, because this is how this boy's brain is set up. And while it may be a mystery to people as to why God would set it up that way, if they use that language, or why nature would set it up that way, that's how it's set up. And we now see that this is natural to these boys. So if we turn away from them, you know, this is creating an incredible pain, because what is natural to the boy is causing his family to hate him. So I obviously beg people to study homosexuality more if they have a boy who's homosexual, and get to know it and understand it more so they don't have fear of it.
An email from Melissa in Richardson asks, how can the education system be revamped in a way that encourages more men to become educators? Do you think that would help young boys?
Well, I'm going to say two things at once, and this is, again, based on experience. One, we can probably increase the number of K through 6 teachers, increase it to males, by about 10%. That's probably realistic, and that's not a high figure, right? We're never going to get 50% K through 6 male teachers. We will get, and we have in some communities, around 50% middle school and high school male teachers. But K through 6, and especially K through 4 and 5, that's going to be dominant female. And there are a number of brain reasons, and I kind of go into those for the book in the book. So there's a lot of reasons, and social reasons, economic reasons. But we need to increase it. And I believe there is a movement now to try to get more males involved in that, and I think we're going to increase it 10%, maybe optimistically 15%. So that's number one. But number two, we don't want to say, well, gosh, if we don't get male teachers in K through 6, we can't improve education for boys, because that's not true. Female teachers, women, when they get trained in this, when they see the PET scans and SPECT scans and they go through trainings and they learn more about it, it's just liberating for them. They say, wow, oh, yeah, I get this now. I understand why these 5 boys are failing in my class. And they make changes. Their intuition and their instincts change, and they help let the boys move around. They help them, you know, they talk louder. I mean, just they start, women teachers will start talking louder, which really helps those 5 boys who don't hear as well as the girls around them. You know, little things like that, that give these guys more water so their brains have more oxygen. There's all these things you can do that sound really tiny, but that add up to more success. And female teachers are predominantly going to do that in the short term and in the long term. So we got to get more males, but we also got to train these women teachers in how to handle the male brain, and we get significant improvement.
Another thing you write about, Michael, is that as boys get older, it's really important for them to be expected to work at more than just school and sports. Can you talk about why?
Well, absolutely. If anyone goes back to their cultural history, like the gentleman about Asia, go back to Asia, go back to Africa, go to Europe, go to South America, wherever your relatives are from, you'll remember that about 100 years ago or before, these boys started working as early as they could. So our great-great-great-grandfathers started working as early as they could. Many of them were apprenticed, and so they were working by 12, 13, and so on. And why? Because we were trying to direct all this boy energy, especially during adolescence, toward goal setting, toward motivation, toward purpose, and ultimately toward caring for the next generation, earning a living and caring for the next generation. Well, we've kind of forgotten that now. So we folks will, when I say this actually in talks or wherever I'm going and speaking, folks will say, yeah, but okay, yeah, I'd love to have my boy working by 16, which is what I say in the book. Let's have them all working by 16. But he's doing athletics, and that's his work.
Got to make time, though, is that right, for the other
work? We got to make time for it, even on the weekends.
Michael Gurian is the family therapist and the author of 25 books. The newest is called The Purpose of Boys, Helping Our Sons Find Meaning, Significance, and Direction in Their Lives. Michael, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.